This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Former Major League Baseball player and current ESPN analyst Doug Glanville recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic about an instance of racial profiling in front of his house in Hartford. He recounts being stopped by a West Hartford policeman responding to a call about an African-American man soliciting in the neighborhood, offering to shovel driveways. Glanville explained that indeed he was shoveling his own driveway and the officer walked away. This story's been talked about around the country. It's even prompted an admission by the West Hartford Police that the officer in question should have been more sensitive. But a driveway encounter like this by a former Major League Baseball player is not the typical case of racial profiling. So today, Where We Live, another look at how the state's laws meant to stop this practice have actually worked. We'll look into the Connecticut Racial Profiling Prohibition Project and find out what they've learned. We'll talk with the former police chief of West Hartford and with the executive director of the African American Affairs Commission of Connecticut. And we want to hear your story. Have you experienced racial profiling in Connecticut? 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email us wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. Our guests in studio are Ken Barone, who's policy and research specialist at the Institute for Municipal and Regional Policy at Central Connecticut State University. Ken, welcome to our show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Joining me also in studio here in Hartford is Glenn Cassis, who's executive director of the African American Affairs Commission of Connecticut. Good to see you once again, Glenn.
Good to see you too, John. Thank you.
And joining us down the line from our New Haven studio is Bill Dyson. He's a former state lawmaker, and he's chair of the Racial Profiling Prohibition Project Advisory Board. Bill Dyson, good to talk to you as well.
Hey, good to be here.
Before we start with you gentlemen, I want to get some response from Jim Stralacci. He's the former police chief of West Hartford. He's been with us on the program before, and we've talked with him about police issues in the past. First of all, Jim, welcome back to our show.
Good to be here, John.
And I will say that we've reached out to the current police chief of West Hartford, who declined to come on our program. We've also reached out to Doug Glanville, who's helped to prompt this conversation, but unfortunately we weren't able to get him into the studio for this conversation. But we do feel it's very, very important, something we've talked about on our show before. Jim, I just would like to get your reaction when you read this piece in The Atlantic. It involves your former town of West Hartford and the town right next door in Hartford. What was your overwhelming conclusion from reading this?
Well, police departments depend on public trust and cooperation. And wherever possible, contacts between police and citizens should be mutually respectful, because customer satisfaction is good for business, and unfortunately vice versa. Whenever there's an unhappy customer, they're going to tell somebody about their experience, and a single complaint of biased policing can alienate a great number of potential customers for a police department all at once. So obviously this sort of thing is that we want to discourage. We want to have the fairest possible policing we can. In any human endeavor, you're going to have mistakes. Mr. Glanville is a big league baseball player. In his line of work, if you bat 500, you're going to be a superstar. In police work, you're expected to do better than that. You're expected to bat 1,000, and no human being is going to bat 1,000. There are going to be places where somebody's going to be unhappy. But our goal as police leaders, community leaders, is to minimize those. To make sure that, where possible, contacts between police and citizens can be smooth, can be mutually respectful, and can leave the citizen with the feeling that he's done something good for his community safety, rather than leaving him feel like he's been picked on or he's been suspected of something that he didn't do.
But that's a very interesting distinction. And for those of us who've never worked in law enforcement, maybe you can explain that a little bit more, Jim. Essentially, you're talking about what you're hoping that the takeaway from any encounter with any citizen is. They should come away from this feeling that they're somehow being helpful to police, even if they are indeed being suspected of something.
Well, I mean, let's look at the real world, not the ideal. In real life, people that break the law don't go around dressed up like a Hamburglar. They don't have a striped shirt and a mask on. So what real police work largely consists of is resolving ambiguous situations by speaking with citizens. Most of those citizens are going to turn out to be completely innocent. The trick is to leave that citizen feeling like he's been, a potential witness rather than a suspect. And diplomacy is the key to that, tact. And it's an art rather than a science. It takes time to learn it, to practice it, and develop it. The rookie or the police officer, the less likely he's going to have that that je ne sais quoi, that ability to diffuse a potentially tense situation and make it feel like the citizen's going to walk away feeling okay about it.
Coming up in a bit, we'll maybe ask a little bit more about how officers are trained to deal with these issues. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking about racial profiling, what we know about how the laws are enforced here in the state, and what we're thinking about after reading this Doug Glanville piece about something that happened right here on the West Hartford line. Again, you can join us at 860-275-7266. Let me ask you, Bill Dyson, for your reaction when you saw this piece by Doug Glanville, what did you think?
I understood it. You know, I can, if I'm the guy shoveling the driveway and someone walks up to me and asks me a question like that, I am going to be ripped. But I understand if you take the other side of it. Yeah, I understand he's doing a job. And so I don't know, how do you resolve that difference between how I perceive his actions to be as opposed to the job that he has to do that the public demands that he does, and that is to make sure that they are safe. And in order to make people feel as though they are safe, you have to be diligent about what it is that you're doing, and you have got to raise those questions to people, whoever they are. And it very often, just as it was said previously, it requires a lot of diplomacy. And we don't often have diplomacy when we are pissed.
Mm. Well, and one of the things that I think Doug Glanville talks about in this piece is he resists the temptation to use the "don't you know who I am" line. And as a longtime state lawmaker, Bill Dyson, I'm sure probably throughout your life that was a decision that you had to face. Someone maybe asked you a question, maybe someone approached you in the wrong way, and you had to choose. Do you want to tell them that I'm one of the most powerful people in the state legislature, or do you just want to be Bill Dyson? I mean, how do you handle that?
I want to be Bill Dyson, to be treated like anybody else. Has it happened to me? Yes, it's happened. Did I get really ticked off? Yeah, I got ticked off. But then you stop and think about it, and that's the difficult thing to do, is to think about it rationally when it's going on. If you think about it rationally, they have a job to do. And they are doing it. Now, does it always pan out the way we would want it to pan out? No. Do all people engage in being as diplomatic as they should be? No. But does that leave a bad taste in some people's mouths? Yes, it does. How do we resolve it? I think we have to, on both sides of the issue, give the benefit of the doubt that somebody has a job to do, in this instance, the police, have a job to do, and they're trying to do that job. Would we ask them not to do the job? So I think it takes a little give and take on both sides. Those who feel that they have been offended, and I have, and those who feel they're doing their job, and people are not getting in the way.
I want to quickly go back to Jim Strelacci, because we got a Twitter comment from G. Scott, who wants to know more about the actual ordinance that the officer was purportedly enforcing and the purpose of it. Essentially, this was meant to stop soliciting door-to-door during a snowstorm. People are asked, you know, do you want to give me some money to shovel the driveway? This is something that's against the law in West Hartford, even though this is happening in Hartford. This is part of the main reason why this all happened. What else can you tell us about laws like this, Jim?
Well, a couple of things. There is an ordinance that speaks to door-to-door soliciting. It's really aimed at people who are peddling things like magazines or cleaning services or products door-to-door. And it's to stop, you have some of these fly-by-night outfits that come from out of state. They bust people in, usually young people, during the summertime, put them up at cheap motels, send them out there with these not legal contracts to pressure people into signing them, forking over their money, and essentially defrauding the customer. That's what the ordinance is speaking to. I think the subtext of this is that during the wintertime, walking around with a shovel is a good prop to somebody who has got something else in mind. We have thefts from garages. We have snowboards that get stolen. We have burglaries. And again, these are committed by people who are not obvious as burglars, and if confronted, can hold off the shovel and say, oh, I'm just looking for work. So I think that's kind of the subtext below both a call to the police station about this person going door to door and what the officer was looking for. He probably wasn't going to really come down too heavy on somebody looking to shovel your driveway if that's what he's actually trying to do. What he was hoping to find, perhaps, was this is a burglar who was using it as a smokescreen.
Glenn Cassis, who's here from the African American Affairs Commission of Connecticut, you were nodding your head as Jim was describing this. Maybe give me your take on laws like this and what role they play.
Well, I can understand the purpose of the laws. I mean, I know those companies that send people out and do the newspaper, do the magazines, all those kind of things. In fact, when I was a kid at Long Island, I was one of those kids who went door to door. That's a way to make some money. Honestly, I thought anyway. But in this case, I just wonder what would have happened if they get many calls, if the person with the shovel going around door to door knocking on doors was white. Would the person at home call and call the police, and would the police do a search around the border of Hartford and West Hartford? And I'm just wondering what would have happened if that was a white person who was doing that, and whether or not people on Mr. Glanville's street would have been stopped and asked by the police, what are you doing, or this kind of thing. I'm just wondering if that would have happened if there was slight changes in that scenario.
And there's almost no way to play the would that have happened game.
Yeah.
I will ask you, because I asked Bill Dyson a moment ago, Glenn Cassis, I assume that this is something where something like this has happened to you in your life.
There have been situations like this, especially growing up as a kid. We had to do school projects where we had to map a particular neighborhood, and we were a teacher had us go around in neighborhoods that we didn't live in, and we had to go around, and we were stopped oftentimes by police asking what we were doing. And this goes back, almost 40 years ago. What were we doing in the neighborhood? We're doing a school project, and it was harassment for us, as far as we were concerned.
We're talking about racial profiling in the program today, and we're talking with Glenn Cassis from the African American Affairs Commission of Connecticut, Bill Dyson, a former lawmaker who is chair of the Racial Profiling Prohibition Project. He is with us from our New Haven studio. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with Ken Barone, who's done some research into racial profiling here, and Jim Strelacci, who's the former police chief of West Hartford. You can join us at 860-275-7266. I will say we got another comment from G. Scott on Twitter, who says, with a no-solicit ordinance like that in West Hartford, there is an open door to automatic citizen-initiated profiling. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to get to a few phone calls that we have lined up. We're going to hear more about some of the research into how the laws against racial profiling in Connecticut are actually being enforced. We want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking about racial profiling. We've been talking about it, as a lot of the country has, after former Major League ball player and current ESPN analyst Doug Glanville wrote a big piece in The Atlantic about an instance that happened outside his driveway in the city of Hartford with a West Hartford police officer. There's a lot to talk about, including the town lines here and the differences between one town and the other. But we're going to be talking in just a moment about how our racial profiling laws are actually being enforced with Ken Barone from CCSU. But we do want to get to some phone calls here, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Gregory, who's calling from my hometown, Winchester. Hi, Gregory. Go ahead.
Hi, John. My comment is this. I think that racial profiling, I'm a white person, and I think that racial profiling is justified by the much greater rate of crimes committed by minorities. And that's my comment.
So before I let you go, what you're saying is that police should be on the lookout for people of color because in the aggregate, you're saying more crimes are committed by people of color?
My understanding of the statistics is that black males, who are 6% of the population, commit 50% of the murders in this country. And I don't think the police should have to ignore that fact in protecting us.
Gregory, thank you very much for your phone call. I want to get some comment from a few of our panelists, but let me bring in Ken Barone from CCSU. He's citing statistics. Some of what you've done is statistics. I don't know if you have statistics like that, but I'm wondering if you could comment quickly on what Gregory has to say.
Yeah, sure. I don't think that as a state we can ever justify racial profiling. And actually, the state has gone out of its way for the last 15 years to explicitly ban racial profiling by law enforcement officers. And when law enforcement officers make a decision about stopping somebody or approaching somebody, they should do so with a set of facts and circumstances that are specific to that case. And so to have law enforcement out there blanketly approaching or stopping one group of people because of a perception out there that they commit more of the crimes is just wrong and never something that we can encourage or should encourage law enforcement to do.
Before we continue this conversation, what more should we know about the actual laws that are on the books? I mean, what do the laws say? What is racial profiling for real?
Sure. So in the 90s, the country had the entire country started looking at this issue of racial profiling. And as a reaction to an incident that happened to the late Senator Alvin Penn from Bridgeport, the state passed in 1999 its first law that prohibited racial profiling by law enforcement officers. And it also required that law enforcement officers collect and record information about the people that they stop in traffic stops. The reason why that's important is because in the state of Connecticut, there are approximately 750,000 traffic stops conducted each year. It is the most common encounter that citizens will have with law enforcement. So it's important to understand the patterns that are developing within those interactions. And in 2012, as a reaction to the incidents that took place in East Haven, the state revamped its efforts to address racial profiling in a more thoughtful way.
When you say the incidents in East Haven, this was the targeting of Latinos in that community.
Yes.
by police. And, of course, it prompted a lawsuit and a court action after a time period. Again, if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Before we move on to a little bit more of what we know about how the laws are being enforced, Bill Dyson, you heard what our caller from Winchester had to say. I think a lot of people, you know, maybe in the law enforcement community, maybe outside the law enforcement community, will say something just like that. How do you respond?
You know, I heard his comment, and I say, oh, okay, I hear where the person is coming from. But it is so out of place. It is so not what takes place. And when he made a point of saying about the murders, which is to imply that all the other crime is associated primarily with people that are black. And, you know, when a person has got that kind of thinking going on, I mean, it's going to be a difficult job to try to alter that or do anything with the person thinking that way. So I just kind of, okay, that's where you are, fine. You got that, and you have a ball with it. I don't agree with it.
But Glenn Cassis, I mean, our caller, there isn't the only person who probably thinks that way.
And he probably isn't, because, you know, just this morning I heard the statement by Bundy, the guy out in Nevada who's has a problem with the federal government in terms of grazing his cattle or whatever. He said a comment just like that, basically that, you know, black people are the criminals and the government keeps giving out those welfare checks and everything else to black people. I mean, it's the same kind of prejudicial comment that, you know, I basically dismiss it because you can't help a person like that.
Let me go to a few quick phone calls here. Tim is calling from West Hartford. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Doug. And Chief, it's Tim Brennan, former partner of yours on the council when you were chief. Hello. Also wanted to say that Chief Strelacci did a great job when he was in West Hartford. I totally agree also with Mayor Slitka, who noted that this was totally unacceptable, what happened, and it's not who we are as West Hartford. But as to the ordinance itself, it actually applies, as Chief said, to the sale of goods, not to services. Secondly, the fact that the police officer crossed into Hartford, where it's not actually, there's no such ordinance, is a problem.
So, Tim, thank you very much for that. Jim Strelacci, you heard, and you're the former police chief of West Hartford. A quick comment on those two points that Tim's making.
Yeah, let me clarify something. The borderline is not really a legal issue. Our statutes are pretty clear, 54.1F of the general statutes. If there's an offense committed in one's own jurisdiction, a West Hartford officer is a complaint of something illegal taking place in West Hartford. He's free to cross the town line to investigate it. He can pursue an offender across the town line, can even make an arrest across the town line, bring the person back. And that happens routinely. I mean, if your bicycle is stolen in West Hartford and an officer sees it riding into, say, Newington, you don't want him to stop at the town line instead of following that bicycle into Newington and getting the bike thief and bringing your bike back to you. As a practical matter, this is legal and it's done all the time. So the existence of a dotted line on a map is not a barrier to an officer fulfilling his duties.
Let's go to Maria, who's calling from New Haven. Hi, Maria. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling. I'm a Latino. I live in New Haven. And in addition to racial profiling, I've just noticed that the treatment of individuals of color by police officers, in the course of, let's say, traffic arrests, it's also an issue. And I think it goes beyond racial profiling and, law enforcement and security. I think the way that Latinos and African Americans are treated, especially in the bigger cities here in Connecticut, is an issue.
Maria, thank you very much for that. And Bill Dyson, you hear what Maria is saying there. Racial profiling is one thing, but it goes beyond, in her mind, just, I think, a lot of what we're talking about. It's the way, in her mind, people of color are perceived by the police in her town and others.
Yeah, I hear that, and I appreciate that. Because, one of the things I do, and there are two points I want to make. One of the things I do is I teach school. And I teach youngsters at Central Connecticut State University. And there I sit with a class, primarily white students. And what I come to find out is how much they don't know about these kind of issues. Because it is not being talked to, they're not being talked to about it, or they don't fully understand the impact of it, and they don't know quite how the perception that I might have in relationship to an issue. So for me, there's the issue of educating the broader public about what these things are and how they go on. Now, the second point I wanted to make is that the shovel, the snow, West Hartford, and if it was enough snow, though, the kids were out of school that day. School was shut down. The best thing to be able to make some money would be get yourself a shovel, kid, go down the street, and make sure that people know that you're available to shovel their walk to earn some money. That human element has gotten lost in this. I know it's not the central issue, but that human element is lost, because here's opportunity that they're taking advantage of, that they would take advantage of, and they'd be moving down the street to do it. And yet it becomes this huge issue of whether someone has been profiled and what is it they fully understand about what that means to the person who's been asked the question, are you shoveling your walk? Well, I'm shoveling my walk here. But I am really ticked because you pointed me out because of my color, not because I'm shoveling.
But I think that's really the key point here is, though, if indeed we just have some kids out shoveling to try to make a couple extra bucks, the reality of what we probably need to talk about, Bill Dyson, whether or not it has to do with police or just citizens, is that if it's black kids wanting to do this, some citizens in a mostly white neighborhood might react differently than if it's a bunch of white kids. I mean, that's
right.
Reality in America right now. And the question is there a law that can do anything about that? What can change that?
I don't know if a law changes that. I mean, you can put the law on the books, but you got to implement it. And I don't know if that changes that. I think what we have to do is what we should have been doing all along and do more of today, and that is just talk to each other. I mean, it's education that needs to take place. I know it sounds so trite, to say that people need to be educated, but if they're not, then we're going to have comments that we get, say, from the guy from Winchester or some other place. They're going to be the guy who's talking about the cows in Nevada someplace. You're going to have that kind of understanding that people have that's not quite what the real story is.
Glenn Cassis, we have about a minute left, but I'd love to get your reaction.
I think it's more than just a police issue. I think it's a matter of communities, how communities need to talk and get to get through these points. I spoke with Doug about this, and he felt the same way. It's a thing that we have as adults need to really have a discussion, a serious discussion with our children, with our elders, about how we relate to one another. I think the police officer was basically reacting to, you know, what the community standards are, you know, and that was a reaction. We need to get down to the heart of it and have a discussion about that.
But that is a big piece of it, reacting to what the community standards
right.
are. Knowing
right.
your community, knowing what people expect, don't expect. That's talking to people.
Exactly. We've got to talk. We've got to do more
talking. And we don't do the kind of talking we need to do, because you have a situation like, for all the violence that goes on in neighborhoods all over the place, who is it that we look to try to find resolution to those issues and to provide security for us? It's the police, but the same ones that we make accusations and whether they are true or not about profiling. So it's a question of our getting around to hearing, listening, talking, community dialogue taking place.
And we'll be talking more with Bill Dyson and Glenn Cassis, also with Ken Barone, and get more statistics on this. I want to thank Jim Stralacci, the former police chief of West Hartford. Thank you as always for your time, Jim. I appreciate it.
Welcome.
When we come back from our break, more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, you know, a lot of what Where We Live is all about is talking about the issues that are important where we live. But another thing that we do quite a bit and that we love to do is talk with the people who are making art and music where we live. As part of our continuing series, we'll bring in Chuck Costa and Mira Stanley. Their band is called The Sea. They just released their debut album, Love We Are, We Love. It's a beautiful record, and they're going to be performing in our Studio 3. They'll share some stories and some music, and I hope you can join us on tomorrow's program. Today, we're talking about a very important issue, racial profiling in Connecticut. We've been talking about it in the wake of an article that Doug Glanville, former Major League Baseball player, current ESPN analyst, wrote about an incident that happened in his driveway in Hartford. So we're talking with Bill Dyson, a former lawmaker and chair of the Racial Profiling Prohibition Project Advisory Board, and also with Glenn Cassis, who's executive director of the African American Affairs Commission of Connecticut. Joining us as well is Ken Barone, who's policy and research specialist at the Institute for Municipal and Regional Policy, Central Connecticut State University. So tell us, Ken, about some of the data that you've actually uncovered here on racial profiling in Connecticut. When we've talked about it in the past, there are these laws that you explained earlier that are on the books. We're supposed to be getting a lot of data coming in from the towns about traffic stops and this sort of thing. We weren't getting that data before. Now we seem to be getting a little bit more. What have you learned?
Right. So on October 1st of 2013, 104 law enforcement agencies throughout the state of Connecticut were required to collect information after every single traffic stop that they conducted. And there was about 25 pieces of information that they are to record and then electronically transmit as a department on a monthly basis to the state of Connecticut for analysis. Our first analysis will be done July 1st of this year. Where we are in this project and in this process is that under the old system, it was reported that only 27 agencies were in compliance with this law. As of March 1st, when we produced a progress report for the General Assembly, 103 out of 104 of those agencies were fully compliant with the changes that the legislature had made in 2012.
So that's a big shift. What's the one town that's not compliant?
The one city that we're still working with is the city of New London.
Okay, so obviously we've seen a lot of growth as in terms of reporting. I mean, what does all the data tell us now that we have all this data?
So the data tells us from the perception of the officer, and this is perception driven, the race, ethnicity, age, and gender of the individual that was stopped. It's also going to tell us why the law enforcement officer stopped that person. Was the car searched? Why the car was searched, if it was searched? What was the reason for searching the vehicle? Why was the stop conducted? For instance, was a license plate reader used? Was a radar gun used? Is that what motivated the stop? What was the officer's motivation for making the stop? And also the geographic location of the stop, among some other points. And that's important because we're making significant advancements in terms of how we analyze this data. For instance, under the old law, an analysis was done which would take the stops that were conducted in a particular community, and they would compare that data to the residents that lived in that community. And I think you and I know that not everybody who lives in a community drives through a community, right? So in Hartford, we have a lot of industry, a lot of employment in Hartford, and a lot of folks from surrounding Hartford are traveling to Hartford for employment or for recreation or for a number of purposes. And so we've actually gotten to a point where we're advanced enough to be able to develop what we call an estimated driving population to understand who is supposed to be driving through a community during the week and on the weekends, and we'll now start to compare who was stopped to who's driving through a community.
Glenn Cassis, I'd love to get your reaction to some of what's been learned. The African American Affairs Commission of Connecticut was originally set up to be the group that would take in and organize all of this information, and it was a daunting task, and people weren't being compliant. How have things changed for you, and how do you view the research that you're seeing now?
Well, I think the research is very dynamic. I think it's really getting down to really getting some data that we can actually use and analyze and make some sense of. It's, as I've always said, numbers can be interpreted anyway. If you dig down further, then you'll be able to understand better. I'm very impressed by what's been going on so far. I think we're really going to be able to determine the effect. And I think what's more important is that we'll be able to take steps to deal with incidents that we feel may not be going correctly.
And I think one of the big things to you, Bill Dyson, is just the amount of compliance that we now see. The fact is that the more information that we have about how police officers in various communities are dealing with the people who they stop, well, this is just important information to have, but also probably gives us an opportunity to change minds, to have this conversation that we want to have.
Absolutely. And, I think one of the things that has not been mentioned here today and does not get mentioned often enough, and that is the commission that we have, the advisory commission that we have, has police on it who are intimately involved in the crafting of this plan that we have put in place to gather this data. And we work together. And part of that working together is to break down the barriers of suspicion that may exist among us, even within that group. So I think we have come a long way, and I have to commend a bunch of police chiefs who've been involved in this, who have taken it upon themselves to be active participants in trying to find a solution to this problem. And I have to commend them for that. And I think what we have to do is to continue to build upon that, to try to make sure that we convey this message to the broader public that all we are after here is to try to make things better, and collecting data will give us some indication as to whether or not we're doing any better.
And I also think that one of the important changes that we've made to the law since October is that we're going to try and be proactive about how we deal with racial profiling in Connecticut. And we're not going to wait for an annual report to come out to say that this town needs a little bit of work or that town needs a little bit of work. But we're developing an early warning system and a tool that police chiefs can use to hopefully prevent a problem before it occurs.
Well, I know that you're involved, Ken, in training. Could you just give us a quick example of the sort of thing that training would do for a police officer, something that you would try to get across that maybe is not clearly evident by their prior training?
Sure. So 12 of us in the state of Connecticut were trained by the Department of Justice-sponsored program called Fair and Impartial Policing. And the idea behind fair and impartial policing is that everybody has bias, even the most well-intentioned person. And law enforcement officials are no different. And as human beings, we tend to fill in what we don't know about other people. And so picture a law enforcement officer approaching a vehicle, and he doesn't know who the driver of that motor vehicle is. All he knows is what the car looks like. Maybe he knows what the individual in the motor vehicle looks like. And so he's starting to maybe make some judgments about that person unconsciously. And that's the important piece of this. And so the training that we're starting to conduct around the state is working with law enforcement to help them better understand the science of unconscious bias and to help them bring their unconscious biases to the forefront of their mind so that they could be more conscious about their biases. And when we're conscious about our biases, we can then change the way that we think or approach a particular situation.
Did you want to jump in, Glenn?
Well, yeah, and I just want to just add about the system. There's a great deal of transparency that's going to be available, and I, if I'm correct, if I'm wrong, but citizens will be able to look at the data as well and get that information. We did not have that possibility in the past. So I think that transparency is going to help us a great deal.
I do want to get to some phone calls here. A lot of people want to join our conversation.
Yeah, so may I add something?
Please, Bill,
here.
Go ahead. Yep.
Ken neglected to mention that we've gone to the Police Training Academy as well, just to make our presentation to police and allow them the opportunity to raise whatever questions they may have in order to establish among ourselves and to the broader public this openness that Glenn talked about, this transparency, to make sure that we're not here harboring some notion that we're going to get somebody. Mm. But what we want to do is create an atmosphere by which we can better respect the people that we serve and those who are applying the law.
Well, one of the reasons why this law is so effective is that when behaviors are being watched, law enforcement have to fill out this form after every traffic stop. So we are now making something that may have been unconscious to them, conscious to them. And behaviors change when people know they're being watched.
It's a large-scale behavior modification. And yeah. Well, let's go to the phones. A lot of people want to ask questions or join us. Teresa's in Bristol. Hi, Teresa. Go ahead.
Hi. I just, going back to what was just said about the bias, I think, a big thing to think about is what we perceive as racism and not. I'm mixed race, and I have lighter skin than, most African Americans. And when I bring up to my friends, and this has been going on since I was a lot younger, that I am, of African American descent, they tell me, oh, but you don't act black. And I think, something that we need to think about is how we perceive the culture of African Americans. And, what an earlier caller said about how African-American men are going to commit more murder, it's the same thing of, so we automatically perceive that black people are going to kill, or black people, act like this or talk like this way. And I think that's going to definitely see when someone sees someone walking across the street, they see them as black, automatically they're going to say to themselves, oh, it's this kind of person, instead of, oh, they're going to be someone just like me. And I think we need to change the way we look at that.
And it's those biases that Ken was talking about that we all walk around with, even police officers, that right. We need to be more attentive to. Teresa, thank you so much for the phone call.
No problem. Thank you.
Really quickly, let's go to Christina in Hartford. We got a few minutes. A lot of people want to join us. Hi, Christina. Christina, are you there? I'm going to put Christina on hold to see if we can get back to her. Paul's calling from Manchester. Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hey, John. I was driving into work today and heard the caller from Winchester, and what he had to say just made my head explode. from my perspective, I found it difficult that you weren't willing to challenge him on what he had to say.
Well,
clearly it sounded like he just had a white hood over his head and a swastika on his arm.
Here's what I'll say, Paul, is I appreciate your phone call as well. I'll do two things. I don't think that we should assume anything about him. The caller from Winchester, and also say that I would assume that our entire conversation today is a response to that type of thought. But I appreciate you sharing your thoughts as well. Wayne's in West Hartford. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead.
Hi. I think a couple callers ago really illustrated how racial prejudices can distort detective work. It can bring these biases and really get in the way of the truth. And getting people around this could be as easy as one time a graduate instructor in a class I was in told us, there is no such thing as race, objectively speaking. And we had never really heard that before, and we actually had to think about that. And since then, I've had to revisit that. And it's always, hit home how much that's actually true. And just as that can be delivered to a graduate class at Columbia, it can be at a police academy training class, or just a group of people together in chairs. Get them to think about that concept and start from there. Right. And then they can get to objectivity.
Well, and first of all, Wayne, thank you very much. It's a great point. But Bill Dyson, that's one of the things when we've had these conversations before, you and I even on this program, there is such a thing as race. And yet there's not. I mean, we have to have a conversation in the reality of America in 2014. I think what Wayne's saying makes a lot of sense. But how do we think about this differently?
I'll say this, and this is me talking. I think that there's a deep and abiding fear of engaging in the dialogue to talk about the issue.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm just going to say quickly, and I know why that is, because I do this on the radio. It's because it's hard to talk about. You have to think about your words very carefully. You don't want to offend, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the guy from Winchester, I mean, that's his exposure, his understanding, and I'll say it is limited. So I don't have enough time to take him through the entire thing and have him understand.
But I think Glenn Cass's part of it, though, is that we have to have a conversation in which people like our gentleman from Winchester, who we've talked about now a few times, can actually say what he thinks that we can talk about it, right?
That's right. Absolutely.
I agree, but you know, there's a place for it. We can't do it on a show like this because we don't have time. But I think we do need to do it. It has to be done, even for the guy in Winchester.
Issa's in New Haven. Issa, we're running very low on time. What's your quick thought?
Yeah, my quick thought is along what you're saying. I think it is difficult to have these conversations, and the individual from Winchester should be allowed to say what he said.
That's right.
At the same time, we need to be honest and call it out for what it is. It's racist. Not that he's a racist, but that type of thinking is. And it's to say that, you know, black men have X statistics, so it's justified for law enforcement to treat them differently, even if they haven't committed a crime, is the same thinking, you know, back in the day, black people are inherently X. So slavery is justified. So segregation is justified. So treating them differently under the law is justified. And it's been discussed earlier, like, it's not good police work. If you're spending energy and resources, you know, scrutinizing someone who's innocent just based on their race, it's wasted time and wasted resources.
Issa, thank you very much for your phone call. We're going to have to leave our conversation there, and there's obviously so much more we want to talk about. I want to thank our guest, Bill Dyson, who's a former state lawmaker, and he's chair of the Racial Profiling Prohibition Project Advisory Board. You can find out more about their work. Just Google Racial Profiling Prohibition Project. There's a lot of information there. Bill, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for being here.
Ken Barone, Policy and Research Specialist at the Institute for Municipal and Regional Policy at CCSU. Thank you, Ken, for your research and all your time.
Thank you.
And thanks to Glenn Cassis, who's Executive Director of the African American Affairs Commission of Connecticut. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much.
Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives with help from Heather Brandon and Lori Mack today. The executive producer is Katie Solarski. This is Where We Live.